Herzlich willkommen bei Meditation Coaching in Life. Mein Name ist Michael Kurt, auch bekannt als Curse. Und in dem heutigen Gespräch hatte ich die rare Möglichkeit, einen der bedeutsamsten und höchsten tibetischen reinkarnierten Lamas ganz direkt zu fragen, wie ist das eigentlich? Und viele andere Dinge. Viel Freude und viel Einsicht wünsche ich euch bei diesem Gespräch mit Kalu Rinpoche. Bevor wir heute einsteigen, möchte ich ein paar Worte sagen zum heutigen Podcast und zum heutigen Gesprächspartner im Podcast und zu den Hintergründen. Als allererstes natürlich Full Disclosure. Ich praktiziere seit über 10 Jahren im tibetischen Buddhismus und deswegen war das für mich ganz persönlich einfach ein sehr, sehr, sehr besonderes Treffen mit Kalu Rinpoche und ein sehr besonderes Gespräch. Ich habe in diesem Gespräch einige Sachen fragen können, die mich einfach persönlich wahnsinnig interessiert haben. Ich habe nicht zu viel über so ganz spezifische, nerdische, buddhistische Sachen gesprochen, sondern ich wollte einfach mal von diesem Mann wissen, wie ist es eigentlich, du zu sein? Diese Frage stellen wir gar nicht so oft, aber in dem Fall von Kalu Rinpoche war es für mich doch die naheliegendste Frage. Kurz zum Hintergrund. Im tibetischen Buddhismus gibt es das sogenannte Tulku-System. Dort werden hohe tibetische Lehrer und Lehrerinnen, hohe Lamas, nach ihrem Tod durch ein System des Wiederfindens und Wiedererkennens als Reinkarnation wiedererkannt. Das bedeutet, junge Kinder, manchmal sind die Kinder wirklich nur 1, 2, 3 Jahre alt, manchmal sind sie aber auch schon etwas älter, werden durch spezielle Prozesse, durch spezielle dafür ausgewählte Menschen als die Wiedergeburt dieses hohen Lehrers oder dieser hohen Lehrerin wiedererkannt. Deswegen ist auch der jetzige Dalai Lama der 14. Dalai Lama. Dieser Titel wird nicht irgendwie vererbt oder durch Ernennung weitergegeben, sondern durch das Finden der Wiedergeburt. So wird es also auch sein, wenn der jetzige Dalai Lama verstirbt und wir hoffen, dass es noch Ewigkeiten dauert, bis das irgendwann mal passiert, dann wird wahrscheinlich auch der nächste Dalai Lama, der 15. Dalai Lama, als Wiedergeburt gesucht und entdeckt werden. Wie Kalu Rinpoche in diesem Interview auch gleich erzählen wird, sind wir für die Buddhisten alles Wiedergeburten. Jeder von uns hat schon Hunderttausende und Milliarden, wirklich unzählige Leben vor diesem gehabt und wird wahrscheinlich auch noch unzählige Leben danach haben. Die meisten von uns können sich aber nicht an vorherige Leben erinnern. Oder, selbst wenn wir es können, werden wir nicht als Reinkarnation von Person XY anerkannt. Im tibetischen Buddhismus ist das auch nur bei einigen sehr, sehr bedeutsamen, sehr hohen Lamas der Fall. Und die Reinkarnation wird dann im Sinne der Vorgänger und im Sinne dieser Übertragungslinie, dieser Reinkarnationslinie ausgebildet, erzogen und nicht nur in den spirituellen Praktiken unterrichtet, sondern er bekommt auch die Verantwortung übertragen, die gesamte Schule mit vielleicht Tausenden, Zehntausenden Mitgliedern auf der ganzen Welt zu verwalten, am Leben zu halten und als spiritueller, aber auch als weltlicher Vorstand dieser Schule zu fungieren. Kalu Rinpoche, der, und das muss man dazu sagen, gerade mal Anfang 30 ist, ist einer von diesen reinkarnierten Lamas, und zwar die jetzt lebende Inkarnation des vorherigen Kalu Rinpoches. Dieser vorherige Kalu Rinpoche hat ein großes Vermächtnis hinterlassen. Er war einer der ersten Lamas, die in den 50ern und 60ern aus Tibet, aus Indien in den Westen gekommen sind, war einer der ersten Lamas, der in Amerika, in Europa Zentren für tibetischen Buddhismus aufgebaut hat, gelehrt hat, der Mönche und Nonnen ordiniert hat und der Retreats, also quasi mehrjährige spirituelle Rückzüge mit Menschen durchgeführt hat, Männern und Frauen, was zu der damaligen Zeit noch sehr ungewöhnlich war. Und er hat also über 100 Schulen und Tempel und Klöster auf der ganzen Welt etabliert. Er war nicht nur spirituell eine ganz wichtige Figur, ein enger Vertrauter des Dalai Lamas, des Karmapas und verschiedener anderer sehr hoher tibetischer Lamas, Lehrer für viele dieser Personen, sondern er war auch jemand, der in der ganzen tibetisch-buddhistischen Welt als einer der höchsten Gelehrten und einer der intensivsten Praktizierenden bekannt und anerkannt war. Mit dieser Geschichte, mit dieser Historie ist der jetzige Kalu Rinpoche quasi zur Welt gekommen. Als er 1,5 Jahre alt war, wurde er als Reinkarnation von Kalu Rinpoche erkannt und dementsprechend dann auf den Thron gesetzt, auf dem Kalu Rinpoche vorher gesessen hat, und hat seitdem sein Leben verbracht in dieser Rolle, in seiner jetzigen Inkarnation. Und wie ihr in diesem Gespräch hören werdet, ist das in vielerlei Hinsicht sehr weit von dem entfernt, was wir uns romantisch vielleicht unter sowas vorstellen. Kalu Rinpoche spricht sofort in den ersten Minuten auch über die Herausforderungen dieser Situation und darüber, was das eigentlich für so einen jungen Kerl auch alles bedeuten kann. Noch kurz, um es zu sagen, aufmerksam geworden auf Kalu Rinpoche, auf seine jetzige Inkarnation, bin ich vor ungefähr 8-9 Jahren durch ein YouTube-Video. Und in diesem Video steht ein junger 20-jähriger Tibeter in Daunenjacke und Timberland Boots und erzählt über seine Erfahrungen, die er machen musste in diesem Klostersystem mit Intrigen, mit Gewalt und mit verschiedenen anderen Dingen, die für so einen jungen Menschen extrem herausfordernd sind. Was mich sofort beeindruckt hat, ist die Intelligenz und die Klarheit, mit der Kalu Rinpoche gesprochen hat, aber auch seine tiefe Ehrlichkeit. Ich hatte nie das Gefühl, dass er versucht, irgendjemanden anzuprangern, sondern ich hatte das Gefühl, dass er versucht, Menschen die Augen dafür zu öffnen, dass wir alle Schwierigkeiten haben und dass niemand damit alleine ist, dass es ihm oder ihr nicht gut geht, dass sie oder er herausgefordert ist und dass auch Dinge passieren, die von denen wir uns gewünscht hätten, dass sie nicht passiert wären. Und dass auch ein tibetischer Lama, ein hohes spirituelles Wesen, jemand, der in so etwas hineingeboren wird, von solchen Dingen nicht frei ist. Seitdem verfolge ich den Weg von Kalu Rinpoche ein kleines bisschen und bin wahnsinnig inspiriert und begeistert davon, wie ein so junger Mann so viel Entscheidungskraft und Weisheit und Humor und auch Resilienz in sich trägt. Ich habe Kalu Rinpoche für dieses Interview an einem lauen Spätsommernachmittag im Park in Berlin getroffen. Wir haben socially distant voneinander im Freien gesessen und haben uns sehr gut unterhalten. Ich war fasziniert und inspiriert von den Dingen, die Kalu Rinpoche erzählt hat und von der Großzügigkeit, mit der er auch seine schwierigen Erfahrungen und Herausforderungen mit mir und dadurch auch mit euch die zuhören, geteilt hat. Alle Infos zu Kalu Rinpoche und vor allem auch den Link zu seiner Facebook-Seite, wo er jeden Sonntag ein einstündiges Facebook-Live macht, wo ihr alle dabei sein könnt, die habe ich euch in den Shownotes hinterlegt und ich habe versucht, vor und nach dem Gespräch Kalu Rinpoche dazu zu bewegen, unbedingt einen Podcast zu starten. Wer weiß, fingers crossed, ob das passieren wird, aber auch die Ressourcen, die jetzt zur Verfügung stehen, um von Kalu Rinpoche mehr zu erfahren, sind schon wirklich, wirklich ganz großartig. Ich wünsche euch allen jetzt viel Inspiration und viel Freude mit diesem Interview. Kommt mit mir und taucht ein in die Welt eines reinkarnierten tibetischen Lamas, der Anfang 30 ist und genauso wie du und ich im Park sitzt und über sein Leben quatscht. Viel Freude mit diesem Interview mit Kalu Rinpoche.
Perfect. Okay, thank you very much again for taking the time and for sitting here. You are a reincarnated Tibetan Buddhist teacher. Okay. You have been recognized as the reincarnation of Kalu Rinpoche when you were just 2 years old. Mm-hmm. Many people in the West, right? First of all, that whole reincarnation business. Mm. It's a big, you know, mystery. People, so many ideas about it floating around. So I'd like to ask you about that. But first, I would like to ask you, a lot of people that I know, they're in their 20s, they're in their 30s. Okay. And they say, you know, I'm looking for my purpose in life. Okay. I'm looking for my calling. Okay. If I would only know what I'm here to do, you know, I think I would be happy.
Okay.
You were 2 years old, okay. And somebody looked at you and said, here's your purpose in life. Yeah. How is that?
For me, of course, when you are 2 years old, you know, you don't have this kind of gravity coming to you saying that that's your life. You just put on the throne and given recognition and given the title of Kala Rinpoche and saying that you are the reincarnated master. But then, you know, just to be clear, that even you are reincarnated in a traditional Buddhist, monastery or institution, whatever you call it, you still have to do a lot of training. Mm-hmm. It's not something that you got a golden ticket and say, mm-hmm. yeah, I got recognized, and you know, and then somehow you got a recognition, and you know, and then somehow you don't need to do any practice, somehow you don't need to put in any effort. And that's the one misconception I think people have to understand, is that all of us, we are reincarnation. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's not something what I believe. It's something what Buddha says. Mm-hmm. You know, the reincarnation has nothing to do with the hierarchy. Mm-hmm. You know, many people, when they perceive the Buddhist reincarnation, they perceive it as a special living being. Mm-hmm. You know, like something very supernatural, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But reincarnation, all of us, we are reincarnation. You know, in general, whether you are Buddhist or non-Buddhist, it doesn't matter. You know, we are all reincarnated because, you know, many children up to 4 years old to 5 years old, they do have a memory of the past. Mm. You know, and then as they grow older to the age, certain age, and then the new memories start to set in, and then the older memories start to fade away. And then when they continue with their life, let's say somehow they happen to meet some spiritual practice. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be Buddhist religion. Mm-hmm. It can be a spiritual understanding, something to do with looking inward, mm-hmm. not just in the emotional level, but the really deeper level of yourself, mm-hmm. understanding the nature of your mind, understanding the state of the consciousness, and then meditating and finding the state of clarity within your mind. And then when you have this sense of calmness and clarity in your mind, and then you know, certain memory of the previous life may come again. Mm-hmm. And that is a possibility. It is not a miracle, mm-hmm. because our mind is very much polluted with so many different things. You know, you don't need to question about your last life. You know, you watch something very terrible movie in the cinema, and that already polluted you for a week. And then again, by the second week, by the end of the month, that memory start to fade away. Mm-hmm. You know, but the pollution that we bring into our mind is enormous. Mm-hmm. You know, and then we only judge on what we see. You know, we don't try to examine the very source of the state of the ignorance, the state of the reflection, the state of the illusion of our own state of mind. We don't question all that. We rather jump to the conclusion, what is white, what is black, and then we are heading on without any sense of clarity in mind. And of course, if you have that kind of a mindset, and then reincarnation explanation does not matter, because there's a lack of clarity within yourself. So you have to keep in mind, you don't have to go around and say, I have a bad karma, good karma, so on and so forth. You know, the long as you keep your mind clear and sense of calmness and sense of clarity, and then some positive memory of the past, some negative memory of the past may come back again. But that needs a dedication, that needs a practice. But that is not the aim of being a Buddhist practitioner.
Mm, sure.
You know, certain memory can come, but that is not the ultimate goal. You know, so that's one thing that people have to understand. Mm-hmm. That. And the second is that, you know, even you are recognized as the Kala Rinpoche, you know, we call that the subtle negative habit. Mm-hmm. You know, when you are born, you are surrounded by a certain negative habit, mm-hmm. or cloudy mind.
Yeah.
You know, and then you need to overcome that. But in the same time, you need to do a lot of practice. You know, even myself, I cannot just say, I'm Kala Rinpoche, I don't need to do 3 years retreat. I went to 3 years retreat, slept in the meditation box, mm-hmm. you know, for 3 years and 9 months. Originally, it's only 3 years and 3 months, but we had to do 3 years and 9 months, mm-hmm. when I was 14 years old. Mm-hmm. You know, so I had to do a lot of training, you know, and it was difficult. It was not easy.
Yeah.
The so-called Kalo Rinpoche name, the title, I could not use for any advantage.
Yeah.
Because there's many other, how do I say, practitioner, you know, who are doing better than me, who are equal to me, so on and so forth. So
maybe you think it's even sometimes the opposite. You think there's a bigger expectation even. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, oh, he's Kalo Rinpoche, so.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes, yes. Definitely there's a, how do I say, a big expectation, but expectation coming from different agenda in different direction. And somehow you have to develop your own future. You have to establish your own direction, mm-hmm. in the terms of activity. You know, the way of focusing on your own version of activities. Mm-hmm. And that is an important matter. Because expectation...
The most important thing is what you do, actually.
Yes, mm-hmm. what you do. But at the same time, when you are surrounded by so many different expectations, mm-hmm. those expectations is coming, majority of the expectation comes from a different generation with a little bit of different mentality. Mm-hmm. And it's not really close to the reality. It's more like a fantasy and expectation coming together. That's the majority of the group of people. Mm-hmm. And there's a minority of the people who surrounds you, who guides you and help you and gives you the practical guidance, mm-hmm. and gives you what's the meaning of life,
yeah.
you know, and what is the real meaning of being Kalo Rinpoche, mm-hmm. and what is the meaning of being a practitioner in general. You know, so this minority group of people that are those are around you. Mm-hmm. Gives you expectation, you know, they have expectation, but more realistic expectation.
Yes.
But the majority of the people have a fantasy and unrealistic expectation in comparison to the 900 years ago, 1,000 years ago, all that kind of a mixed together expectation. So, you know, when you have to get along with that kind of expectation, it's a challenging.
Did you ever have a moment or a phase where you thought, oh, this 1,000-year lineage expectation, that it sounds kind of nice. Maybe, you know, did you ever have a moment like this where you yourself sort of and I hope it's okay to ask, you know, where you sort of you know, I make music, right? Mm-hmm. So sometimes, you know, it's no comparison, but you know, sometimes I'm in the public public light, and there have been moments in my life where I kind of wanted to believe. Mm-hmm. That's true, you know, that this fantasy is true. This is like, maybe I am really this special person, you know. I had to drop out of that, you mm-hmm. know. But have you had situations like this, or have you always had a very good inner circle or good guidance to sort of keep you realistic with your own practice, your own expectations?
Mm. You know, the reality changes as you grow. And because the very definition of the so-called holding the organization together comes down to maintaining the Dharma centers and the monasteries and the meditation centers around the world based on your predecessor's legacy. Mm-hmm. You know, so you have that version of the reality mm-hmm. that you have to continue. Mm-hmm. You know, but at the same time, for me, it was. You know, in the beginning, of course, everything is about practicing Dharma, keeping it simple. You know, I don't even have idea of going to the foreign country. I was, you know, when I was younger, you know, I was thinking about, okay, if I succeed in this 3 years retreat, maybe I will just become an abbot of the monastery and, you know, just simply be a practitioner. Mm-hmm. But then when I came out of the retreat, and then there's a different group of people who come together, and then those who have an idea of how can I use Kalo Rinpoche to my own advantage?
Yes.
And then there's a group of people who are like that. And then there's a group of people who are genuinely dedicated, willing to support, willing to offer their commitment and dedication for your activities and your vision, whatever you call it.
Yes.
You know, so there's always a different kind of scenario.
Yeah.
You know, so of course, in the beginning, you stick with the practice Dharma, you know, meditate, and you know, continuing with your daily principle. Mm-hmm. But then as you come out of the retreat, and then you are awakened in a different reality, which is you are expected to hold on into the lineage of Kalo Rinpoche, the responsibility of the meditation and the monastery and so on and so forth. And of course, it's very challenging, because there's a lot of politics involved. There's all the financial management involved. There's all the legal documents that you have to oversee. There's a debt and a credit that you have to oversee.
Which I think is something that people don't, you know, they don't look at that. Yeah. They're like, oh, it's this. Everybody just meditates, and it's all the monks, and everybody's, yeah, you know. So, but it's a big organizational issue.
Yes,
also,
yes, yeah. Yes. You have to oversee all these things and make sure that everybody follows the rules of the rules of each countries, and yes, making sure everything is clear cut and transparent. Yeah. You know, so it was quite an effort. But at the same time, I never thought of myself as a, hey, look at me, I'm Kalu Rinpoche, I'm a great master. And I never had this bubble, because every time I read the biography of my predecessor, I don't imagine myself of him, because, you know, he did retreat for 12 years, you know, and I don't compare myself to him. No. I believe that I'm a reincarnation of him, but I do not believe that I have the same standard of qualities, or the realization, you can call it, you know. I believe I can make a different approach, mm-hmm, you know, but not a greater than him, you know. So that's how I put myself, you know. And then the most important is that I keep a sense of humbleness as my own attitude along together in my daily life, and also in my responsibility as well. So that kind of helped me, guided me, mm-hmm, yeah.
Were there ever times where you really felt like, is this really what I want to do?
No, yes, yeah, definitely. There's a lot of times that, how do I say, when you are given chance to the lamas of the centers, where you give them chance to make, because they make an error. Mm-hmm. They want to, not all of them, but some of them want to use the meditation center or the temple as their own personal property. Mm-hmm. Which I'm against that, mm-hmm, you know. And then there's many times, you know, they make a lot of excuse to themselves, where they say, oh yeah, I'm a practitioner, but I need this one, I need that one, I need this one. Like this, there's no needless attitude. There's a more overwhelming, mm-hmm, needing attitude, mm-hmm, which is the opposite of being a practitioner in general. Mm-hmm. And then yet pretending to be a great practitioner, mm-hmm, you know. And then that kind of people, I gradually remove them. Hmm. You know, first I give them chance, I give them time, I give them space to recover their, how do I say, recover themselves, mm-hmm, and reconnect, and give them some time to reconnect, and, mm-hmm, you know, take a little bit of space, and telling them that take your time, take a break for 1 year, maybe 6 months, come back to me after that, once your mind is clear, you know. And but then still, they make so many decisions based on their own greed. And then there was the times where I say, is this really the life that I want to have? Because if this is the reality, I want to keep on happening, you know? Yeah. If this is the reality that keep on repeating again and again. Mm-hmm. But then at the same time, you start to understand that, you know, you have this kind of a hope, and then your dedication, so that more and more people can go to the meditation place and go to the Dharma center or the monastery to meditate, to learn about themselves, you know. So you are making sure that, you know, that keeping the platform alive as possible, mm-hmm, you know. So by seeing that, it gives me the purpose, you know, it gives me the strength and the courage, mm-hmm, you know. So otherwise you don't find any purpose for doing all that, isn't it? Mm.
You know, I had this picture in my mind, mm, when you were just talking, mm, about there being a difference between being put on the throne, mm, as you said when you were 2 years old, mm, put on the throne, yeah, and actually assuming it, like actually holding it, mm-hmm, you know, like, and that, I think, I just felt that when you talked about that, because it has to do with making decisions, with assuming the role, with, you know, with trying to make the best, mm-hmm, possible decisions, mm-hmm, and actually, and that again comes down to, you know, not what is your destiny or something, but, mm-hmm, what is your action, like, mm-hmm, like how do you actually relate to the situation you are in, mm-hmm, you know. And would you say that even though you're in a new generation, mm-hmm, you know, of practitioners and tulkus, would you say that your approach is traditional?
Mm. Yeah, my approach is very much traditional. I mean, when I meet people in the public, I will have a casual conversation, I will have open discussion, and they may look at me a little bit like I'm open to any criticism. Mm-hmm. You know, I will criticize everything, I make a joke and so on and so forth, that is my approach. Mm-hmm. You know, but when you actually have to practice, and then there's no modern way of doing it, you know, and that's something I don't understand about this so-called modern Buddhist movement.
Yeah,
you know, because when you practice, you need a solitary. Without a solitary, you cannot succeed in your practice, no matter what. Mm. You know, anybody who can try to give a sweet talk to you, well, that's good for their business, good for their image, because they tell you what you want to hear. Mm-hmm. You know, but in the reality, you can do a solitary retreat even in your own apartment. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't mean you have to go to the mountain or leave your family behind, mm-hmm. or, you know, leave everything behind. You don't have to go that far. You know, but solitary retreat can be happening in the apartment, it can happen in your, whatever the lifestyle you may have. So the solitary retreat is a very important matter for people, because without the solitary retreat, there's no sense of calmness and clarity in mind that comes by itself. Mm-hmm. There's no, you know. So when you make a solitary retreat, and then the naturally, how do I say, the strength of your mind and the clarity of how you judge your emotion without any arrogance, and how you perceive your state of the illusion improves gradually by itself, you know. So therefore, you know, my method, when I meet people, yes, I give an open talk, we discuss about everything, you know. I will try to speak in a different language, you know, with a different translator and so on and so forth, you know. But when it comes to practice, I cannot, there's no some kind of a shortcut I can give it to you. You know, so definitely in that way, I'm old school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but in terms of introduction, you can call me a new school.
You know? So when you talk about solitary retreat that you can do at your house, could you give an example? Yeah. How one could incorporate something like that into their life?
Into their life, I think it depends very much into your family relationship.
Sure.
You know, if you have a very, how do I say, discomfort situation,
mm-hmm.
and then of course, wherever you go with your family, then you're always, you know, a little bit of argument here and there will always occur. You know, there's no magical solution I'm offering right now. What I'm trying to say is that, you know, once in a week, like example, in a Friday evening, you enter the retreat, and then the Sunday morning, mm-hmm. then you complete the retreat.
Mm-hmm.
Like an example, staying in your own one small space, you know, minimize the so-called the gossip,
mm-hmm.
the conversation, unnecessary conversation about the righteous self-righteousness, minimizing that. And then at the same time, minimizing the engagement with other people, just for Friday to Sunday morning.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody will consider you are abnormal.
Mm.
You know, everybody see you on Monday work, Wednesday work, you know, you still have a family, you still have a job, you still have everything intact. Mm. But you have to start somewhere, you know, because the problem with nowadays people is that they do this Dharma practice a little bit like a gym routine,
mm-hmm.
you know. It's a little bit like how many accumulation mantra I should do it.
Yeah.
And that's the main problem with the Buddhist people, because of course, it gives a solution for a very, very, very lazy people, you know, to encourage them to reach that goal.
So you have to do 100,000?
Exactly.
And next?
Yeah. But then the reality of the Dharma practice is beyond the numbers. It has nothing to do with how many numbers you accumulate, you know, because the reality of the practice is that first you bring a sense of calmness to yourself,
yeah.
you know, and bring the physical discipline first. And then bring the state of mind discipline after that, and then along with it, and then apply this short-term solitary retreat. You know, enter to the retreat on the Friday evening, make a one session, and then on the Saturday make a three session, 2 hours each per session, and then on Sunday morning make a one session. You know, like that, and it is a possibility, and that is much more greater. That has a much more greater effect comparison to the people who do this kind of a routine thing, you know, like oh, 7 o'clock in the morning, I have to do this deity practice. Mm-hmm. And then like in this 8 o'clock in the evening, I have to do this protector practice. You know, mm-hmm. they believe, first, the wrong misconception is they believe in numbers. That's the number one misconception. Second is they believe in the so-called wrathful deity should be in the evening, and the more pacified feature deity should be in the morning. There's no, you know, morning, evening, mm. you know, timeline. You practice when you can, mm-hmm. you know, but when you do it, be aware of your distraction. You know, I always say, count your distraction, not the mantra. Mm. You know, the more you're aware of your own distraction, and then the quality of the practice improves by itself. You know, because if you try to follow the number, then you are trying to feed your own ego. Basically the same thing as trying to be rich and trying to buy expensive car and showing everybody that you're rich. You don't need to do that. You know, you can be a very good person and you can be a very attractive person. You know, so the problem with majority of the people is that they change the direction and then they keep the same habit. They change the colors, mm-hmm. but they keep the
yes.
same habit.
Yes.
And then expecting to have some kind of a happiness all of a sudden in their mind,
yeah.
you know, and it's impossible. You cannot achieve or succeed in that way, you know. You keep the same habit, you know. In our ordinary life, you buy expensive car, you have a nice, very big apartment, and then you have a family and property and companies and so on and so forth, and then you like to show to other people. Building on your own, there's nothing wrong. But the problem is that when your ego is there, which is not part of any management skills, you know, you can be a good manager without any ego.
Yeah.
You know, but the moment you have a, you know, everything established in a good way, the moment your ego starts kicking, and then everything goes to dust. Mm. Just like that in the Dharma practice, if you try to feed your ego by saying, I have practiced this, where other students did not have any connection or any opportunity mm-hmm. to do this practice. I've done a retreat where they could not. I have received the empowerment where they did not. Mm-hmm. I have accumulated mantra to immense numbers where others have did not. And then I have made a renounce. I made a renunciation. Look at me. I'm so pure and perfect. Everybody must recognize how unique I am. That is the ego. Mm. You know, that is more like justifying your own ego. Mm. But you are keeping in the same cycle. The meaning of the renunciation does not mean you change your clothes, you shave a hair, you move to a different location. Mm. You know, the meaning of the renunciation means, you know, you renounce the illusion of your mind. You know, and that is the true meaning of renunciation. Renunciation does not mean changing clothes or relocating yourself. Renunciation means not spinning into the same cycle. The very source of the spinning into the same cycle comes from the illusion of our own mind. So the moment you minimize that, not like hitting with a hammer, but you know, once you minimize that habit of recognizing the distraction, recognizing the illusion, and then definitely, gradually, the sense of calmness and then the kindness attitude to others, you know, strengthen your mindset, you know, becomes the new normal.
Mm. You're talking about minimizing.
Mm.
Sometimes it might appear like a lot of people, especially when they enter a spiritual path or when they realize something in my life is missing or I have to look at myself, or they enter into some kind of spiritual practice maybe with another expectation, maybe with an expectation of having special experiences, having more, like a more seeing more colors and remembering the past life and having all these special experiences,
yeah.
you know. And here you are yeah. talking about minimizing.
Yeah.
Minimizing the distraction
yeah.
and minimizing how attached you are to the illusion of your mind, which yeah. is also a great, we could, I think, speak for okay. 3 years about what is the illusion of mind.
Okay. Okay?
So you're talking about, maybe not, you, yeah. tell me, right?
Okay,
but,
okay.
But you're talking about minimizing.
Yeah.
So do you think it's a problem that people would like to maximize and people would like to have special experiences and do more and sort of get the feeling of, oh, I've had these experiences, now I'm on a spiritual path, now I'm, you know.
Yeah.
It seems like you're speaking about the opposite.
Yeah, I'm speaking the opposite because if you look at the Milarepa, he is the greatest master that ever lived in the Tibetan history. He have never left a monastery or organization behind. You know, the only thing he had left with him was a white cloth that he was just simply covering his body. You know, and he was praised by even the great Mahasiddhas of India. You know, as in Tibetan history, it doesn't happen all the time. You know, to be respected and to be devoted from the Mahasiddhas of India. You know, so the Milarepa was a great enlightened being that was even praised by the great practitioners of India as well, you know, or enlightened being, whatever you call it, you know. So, so I think people have to understand that as well. That's the number one point. Number two is that they have this romantic view about the student-teacher relationship and, you know, oh, you know, I need to have a teacher and, you know, very much dependent, you know. And then when it comes to practicing Dharma, they put very little effort. When it comes to being close to the guru and teachers, and they maximize that. But the very purpose of having a teacher is to provide you the Dharma, but he cannot provide you the full Dharma or the full his own full experience without you putting in any effort. You know, that's a little bit like you know, you're having a visual problem and then somebody gradually cleaning your eyes, you know. You know, if somebody tried to slap out of your eye, and then of course it will hurt you. You know, so you know, so the gradual approach is needed from the teacher, and the gradual approach, you know, from the student is needed. But the problem with the modern world is that, you know, not just in the modern world, also in the olden time, is that the student have this kind of a very much a fantasy about all these magical things. You know, the moment you go, you know, the moment you step into the magical things, experience, if you are going for that, I mean, it's great. I mean, there will be some time where you can see the vision of the future. And if you are a great practitioner, which I have experienced that as well. But if you circulate your mind into that, there's nothing it from itself that can provide you in terms of happiness or calmness or sense of solution to you, you know, to your state of the consciousness. You know, there will be many experiences that you may achieve, that you may experience here and there. We call it a positive sensation. If you focus on the Dharma practice in general, it doesn't have to do with deity practice or which one. Just if you do shamatha, vipassana practice, there will be some kind of a transformation and sense of a vision that you will see here and there, simply because your mind is very much, you know, solid, not waving here and there like a flag, you know. So then there will be always a, you know, foreseeing the future, some vision like that, some clarity like that. It can occur, but the moment you grasp, the moment you grasp, then everything beautiful as may be, you know, but everything will become useless the moment you grasp. So that's, therefore, you're free to experience whatever you want. But the moment you grasp, then you are in the cycle, you know. So whatever you experience, you know, be present with that experience, whatever the beautiful experience you may had, you know, within the journey of your practice, whatever you, the spiritual journey practice you may be heading into, whether it's a Theravada or Mahayana or Vajrayana or simply experimenting, whatever you may call yourself. And the most important is, whatever the positive accumulation and sensation you may be having today and tomorrow. And then, at the same time, the most important is not having any grasp towards that. Have appreciation, but do not grasp for it. And that's the most important key. The moment you grasp, then you are very unhappy about what I had and what I did not. And then it becomes the gossip of your mind. Then it becomes a distraction. You know, so I had a very beautiful practice yesterday, but today I was feeling very low, and so on and so forth. You know, that is a wrong attitude. You know, you must continue your practice, and that is the most important. The moment you have a sensation of grasping, then gradually it will come to greed, And gradually it comes to the ego and recognition with the self-righteousness. You know, so the very important matter is all of us, we are capable of experiencing many things. But the moment we grasp, we become incapable of, you know, of succeeding it. So that's the most important key.
So how do we not grasp?
Start with a solitary retreat. It's very simple. You start with a solitary retreat. First, you know, you start with a needless attitude. The first positive sign that you are practicing good in good direction is that you start to have a few seconds of glimpse of needless attitude. And then slowly, you know, your body and your mind itself will become a little bit more light. Light in a sense, how do I say, very calm, very clear, very stable, you know, and not vulnerable to different interaction from external appearance of things, whether it's very attractive, whether it's very unpleasant, you know, your mind will be more solid and more firm. And then as you continue with that, how do I say, with that sense of solitary retreat and practice, and then naturally what you eat, you know, and the taste, what you want to experience becomes a little bit needless. What you wear also becomes needless. Then you will become a simple-minded individual practitioner with a great joy constantly, you know, without any interruption. And then at that stage, you know, you will have some positive sensation for seeing the future, you know. And then, or like an example, like when you go, you know, when you go to sleep, then you will have a very light sleep, not the paranoia, you know, a light sleep.
Yeah.
Like an example, you go to sleep for a few hours, and then the moment you wake up, you have this feeling that you just woken up after 5 minutes of nap. You know, your mind is clear as that. You know, a little bit like very much tender and ready to reconnect with your practice. Whether it's a guru yoga practice, whether it's deity practice or protector practice, doesn't matter. But your sense of awakening state of mind is crystal clear and very sharp and is present. You know, so that is a gradual progress. But the first progress that you can see and recognize is, you know, a few seconds of needless attitude. You know, oh, everything is in permanence. That is really true. Just that much in the beginning.
Yeah.
You know, it may not be for the first few weeks, but maybe after 1 month, and then, you know, all of a sudden, you know, you are simply doing the meditation practice, or maybe you are simply reading some sutras, maybe you are reciting the six syllables Om Mani Padme Hum, and then all of a sudden you have this sense of awakening in your mind where you say, everything is illusion, everything is truly impermanence. I have been ignorant until now. You know, just a few seconds of that, and then slowly, that will, the length of that will grow longer and longer. And then the needless attitude as a practitioner and the kindness and loving to others will become the new normal. You don't have to say, I have to be compassionate or I don't want to be compassionate. You don't have to worry about whether other people betray you or not at that point. You know, when we are not compassionate, then we say, we are worried about, oh, other person will betray me. Then what to do? What is the solution? And the problem that what people have to understand is that we can focus on the loving kindness, which is what His Holiness Dalai Lama is promoting all the time. So we can focus very much into loving kindness, very much, as a foundation. The compassion is a state of mind that where you have a full realization of the realization of non-existence of self. You know, when you have that realization, then you are compassionate all the times. But during the progress of the beginning stage, we don't have to push ourselves to be compassionate. The problem with the many people, including myself in the beginning, is that we try to be compassionate. You cannot be compassionate. It doesn't work. You know, the way if you continue with the meditation, loving kindness, and then the compassionate gradually, you know, that state of mind will come by itself. But during the progress, you need to have a loving kindness combined together. And then the sense of recognition towards your distraction all the time. And then all these three combine together, and then gradually you have few seconds of needless attitude, you know. But that comes down to solitary retreat.
Yeah. So this is something that you do would advise to anyone, to any of your students or people that just ask you to really take that alone time, that solitary time.
Yes.
To minimize the distraction and to just sit.
Yes. Yes. Because like 9 years ago when I started my responsibility, everybody who invited me in like a different Dharma centers or here and there or like in the universities, you know, it's more like give a talk.
Yeah.
Or give a talk or give empowerment.
Yeah. Yeah.
So like you have this two majority group of people where there's two extreme group. One is like intellectual, intellectual only. And one is belief and the belief only.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have this two group of large numbers of people. And then you feel kind of lost as a practitioner because you feel a little bit like, what's the meaning of that?
Yeah.
You know, how can I help these people? How can I help myself as a practitioner? You know? So what I did was that, you know, I changed the style of the schedule. Basically, I don't do, how do I say, like a public talk as much as before. Mm-hmm. What I try to do is I do retreat with people.
Okay.
So I do retreat with like 1 week retreat, two weeks retreat, sit together, one meal a day, no evening meal, minimize the conversation, you know, and then with 5 o'clock in the morning, we go to the temple, make a commitment vow, you know, so on and so forth, like a sojong vow, we call it. So we do it like that. So then it is more helpful for my, how do I say, myself as a practitioner, and it was helpful for the people. So that is always the solution I give to the people. Yeah.
To practice.
Yeah, to simply practice. And of course, here and there, I will recommend some books, some teachings from the different masters. But mainly, they have to spend time with the practice, solitary retreat, you know. Like an example, in France right now, we have a six ladies who are in the 3 years retreat. They are in the third year. I have put them in the retreat 2 years ago, and they are in the third year, and then and the 1 year later, then they will come out.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Two questions. Just in the Palen Shangpa 3 year retreat, is it sort of you practice the six yogas or?
Yes. We have the six yogas of Niguma and the six yogas of Sukhasiddhi. So these are the two female master originated from India. So these two masters, they give teachings, and so we do their yogas, and then also the five jewels of Niguma, you know, so, yeah.
So when you did your retreat, you started, you said when you were 14. I have a son who is 15.
Okay.
So I know what he likes, you know, he likes to hang out with his friends, listen to rap music, and you know. So, How was that for you, you know, at that age to go into the retreat? Was it natural? Was it like, oh yeah, this is what I do, or?
Well, I, first of all, I think just to speak a little bit normal as possible, without being too serious about it. When I was 13 years old, you know, and then my teacher said to me, not as personal teacher, but more like lineage teacher. You know?
This is Thaisitu Rinpoche?
No, Boka Rinpoche.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. He was the student of my predecessor. Mm-hmm. So, Sudha Rinpoche also follows the recommendation of that as well. Mm-hmm. So, he told me that if I want to go for 3 years retreat or if I want to go to university, you know, like Tibetan university.
Yeah.
And I said, well, I want to go to a university.
Yeah.
And then he said, well, definitely you're thinking about the summer vacation and the winter vacation. I said, yes, you ask me and I give you an answer. And then he said to me, you know, take a week off, have a holiday, think about it, come back. And then if you change your mind, I want to hear it. So I came, I had a good holiday for 1 week where other people were studying, I didn't have to. And so I went back and he said to me, so what is your decision? And I said, I'm going to university. Then he said, no, you're not. You're going for a retreat. I said, okay, no problem. You know? So that's what you're telling me? I said, okay. So he said, I am building this house just for you to do the 3 years retreat of the Shangpa tradition. You know, who do you think I'm building that for? So he made sure everything is in place. But a few months later, he passed away, you know, when I was 13 years old. That was very sad because he was like my second father figure, you know, who was beyond the religious mentality, you know, a monastic mentality, you can say it, you know, more like a family who's looking after you, making sure you're well, making sure you're well fed, making sure nothing is going wrong, you know. So he was very much important figure, you know. And but then when he passed away, and then there was a, you know, of course I had to go to 3 years retreat. And I didn't know what was teenager at that time. I don't even have any idea about what is teenager.
Yeah.
You know, only after I came out of 3 years retreat when I was 18 years old, then I discovered what is actually teenager. Then I realized, oh, okay, I lost 3 years. I lost 3 years of my teenager life. Okay, that's fine. Time to catch up.
Did you catch up? Yeah, I was going to ask you.
I tried to catch up, okay. But then when I look at the actual teenagers, and then I said, no, yeah. I don't want to go that much.
Mildly catching.
Yeah, mildly. Yeah. I just want to keep up with maybe 1 year or two.
Yeah.
You know, but then because you're never taken break from your responsibility. You're constantly engaged with your responsibility. Sometime you have to travel, sometime you have to teach, and sometime you're managing with some legal matters of different centers around the world. You know, so you are never like separated and where you say, oh yeah, let me enjoy my life. And you know, you have a little bit of time here and there where you where you see something as a teenager life, but then, you know, you're always back to that reality.
If I may ask you, I read at some point in time, I believe it's maybe 2 years ago, I'm not sure.
Okay.
I read something, and I hope I'm remembering correctly, that was along the lines of, please stay away from alcohol. Mm-hmm. If you're a student of Kala Rinpoche or a friend of Kala Rinpoche, I would advise to you not to drink alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Could you say something about that?
Yes. Definitely, because I used to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not something like, because I think I have to tell you a short story.
Sure.
Yeah, because you know, when you are recognized as Kala Rinpoche, especially in the 21st century, it's like being the part of the legend,
mm-hmm.
and you are the legend, because the predecessor actually one of the first few master who actually came to the West.
Yeah.
I have no idea how to speak English.
Yeah.
You know, came to Germany, France, England, and then the Scandinavia as well, and also in North America, and they give teachings, establish a Dharma centers, you know, and then establishing a monastery and a retreat center for male and female.
Yeah.
You know, separately, but equally giving them importance and giving them the title of the Lama.
Yeah.
So he was the first one who actually not just coming to the West, but also establishing this so-called 3 years retreat in the West, mm-hmm. in the history, mm-hmm. and then giving the title of men and women equally, you know. So that's, you know, and not just that, he was the, you know, he established so many Dharma centers around the world, you know, and then also a very personal, close to His Holiness Dalai Lama as well. And offer a lot of his assistance and support for the Tibetan administration during that time, you know. So he was regarded as not just from the Western people, but also from the official who holds the Tibetan Buddhism together, His Holiness Dalai Lama, respected, admired very much to the previous Kala Rinpoche, requesting previous Kala Rinpoche to give empowerment to his own monasteries, you know, so on and so forth. So there's, and not just that, you know, he was the give empowerment to all the regions of the Karmakaji,
mm-hmm.
Masters in the late 80s,
mm-hmm.
a few years before he passed away. So he have this kind of this the big image,
yeah.
a legend, legacy, yeah, the legacy and the legendary image where nobody can compete or compare to him, you know, because he was among the first one who actually came out of Tibet in the, how do I say, in the late 50s and early 60s. And he already established a monastery and a retreat center in Bhutan. You know, he was the abbot of the monastery and sent by 16 Karmapa, you know, by the royal family of Bhutan, so on and so forth. So he had this kind of an incredible storyline. And my late father was his nephew and an attendant and servant, whatever you call it. And but then when he passed away, of course, he made it very clear, all the legal authorities, and goes to his nephew, which is my father. And then at the same time, you know, when I was recognized as a Kala Rinpoche, reincarnation, and so on and so forth. Of course, that time I do not see any differences, you know, because you are simply having a very good time of your life, because everything, everybody surrounded you, loves you, respects you, cares for you. And not just that, your own father was there, you know. But then when I was 7 years old, he passed away. And then when he passed away, and then everything kind of scattered, you know. There's so many different relatives, you know, coming, you know, coming from different direction and different organizations. So all the Dharma centers was a little bit kind of divided into different groups. And then the monastery management was split into different groups. So there was like complete chaos about who takes what, you know. It was a little bit like the free market.
Okay.
You know? And it was very challenging. Yeah. And for me, I could literally see that, you know, within within a month of my late father passing away. And it was a kind of a very big reality change. Because you're treated like a prince. And then all of a sudden, you start to lose everything. And that losing process, you can witness in the front of your eyes, who is catching what, who's doing which one, and you could witness all of that. But with my, as I made my commitment, I went to be, you know, with Boka Rinpoche, and I studied there. And when I came out of, you know, so when I came out of a 3 years retreat, then I start to reorganize the whole organization, you know, until now. You know, so that's why Boka Rinpoche was the important figure.
Yeah.
That's why, you know.
Yeah.
So it was a lot of struggle. You know, it was definitely not what people imagine. You know. So, what was the question?
It was almost an answer already, but we were talking about alcohol
and the alcohol. So when I came out of the 3 years retreat, as I've been telling you, in 2008, you have this kind of a very beautiful bubbles, you know, religious beautiful bubble, you know, almost like a monk attitude, you know, very simple and how it should be and should not be.
Yeah, sort of the sort of being in the effect of the retreat,
like
being in this state.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's a little bit like, you know, being in this kind of a very straightforward, very clean cut, no compromise, you know, that kind of a mindset. But then when I came out, you know, during that time of within that year, so-called my, you know, my managers, and they tell to the public, how do I say, Kala Rinpoche is already 18, he can say and do whatever he wants to the public. But when it comes to my own decision, such as I want to go to see Situ Rinpoche and receive the Shangpa transmission again, because it goes all the way back to the 16 Karmapa, the lineage. You know, so I wanted to receive the empowerment. So then this manager people, they say, no, you don't need to. You know, so such as political agenda.
Yeah.
You know, so like, oh, I cannot go to see my own guru. I cannot receive my own empowerment. Or like an example, when I ask for financial assistance, in order to receive a grand empowerment that takes a 1 month, you need a financial, how do I say, a strength. You can't just go and knock the door and ask for it. And when I asked for my own management team, and they said, no, they don't have any financial possibilities. So I had to, how do I say, manage that all by myself when I was 18 years old. And then at that time, how do I say, my own personal teacher, not the guru mm-hmm. teacher.
Yeah.
I need to make that clear. Mm-hmm. My own personal teacher tried to assassinate me, you know,
wow.
Because I appointed somebody else as a part of the manager, mm-hmm. you know, to communicate with the different centers abroad. Mm. Because we need somebody who can communicate through emails, talk, make a phone call whenever it's needed. You need sure. the flexibility of communication. So, but then at that time there was a life, you know, assassination saying that, you know, we will, you know, I will kill you and so on and so forth. Mm. You know, I injured my own hand. It was an actual, you know, close contact.
Yeah.
And then, and my own mother supported that person after that. You know, so you survived for a night, you know,
yes.
and then you start to say, what's going on? I've known this person for my whole life, and somehow this person simply not happy with the person I appointed, and then now he wanted to kill me, and he did try to kill me, you know, and we have all the pictures, and then, you know, but then at the same time, I was telling myself, well, this will be fine. Maybe mm-hmm. soon, because I'm the head of the monastery, I can speak and compromise things. Then my mother tried to come, you know, from all the way from her hometown, because they were very good friends. And she tried to come, and then, how do I say, she said, oh, no, nothing is wrong, everything is fine, you know. And then my mother supported him, and that was very painful to witness that. Because losing a father when you're 7 years old, and then, of course, going into the retreat that you never had a family life, mm-hmm. you know, but you always have this, how do I say, you hold one of the family member close to your heart. Mm-hmm. But when you see that, you know, in a different scenario, such as like, you know, your own mother supporting the person who tried to mm-hmm. assassinate you, and then you say, okay, I think this is enough for me. Mm-hmm. And I said in the meeting, very clearly, if I have to put my life on the line, and being a Kalu Rinpoche, I don't think I can carry on. Mm-hmm. You know, because being a Kalu Rinpoche means being responsible of my own action, being responsible for my monastery, for the education for my monks, which we have around 150 monks, children, elder, and senior as well. That is the definition of being Kalu Rinpoche. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be wrong in your opinion. I cannot even see my own guru, mm-hmm. you know, because you want to hold all the power. And if the power is what you want, please take it. Mm-hmm. I don't want the power. I simply want to survive at this point, mm-hmm. you know. And then they say, oh, no, this is getting out of hand. And then they resign and they left. Mm-hmm. And then that was the time where I started drinking alcohol. You know, I said, you know what, forget it.
Yeah.
You know. You know. And this that was
very understandable. Yeah.
Yeah. But then, as you travel to the West, you try to imagine where you think, yeah, maybe the Dharma centers are managing quite well, and then you bump into another obstacle, which is, you know, you have the financial debt, and you have the lamas who are misbehaving, you know, in terms of their responsibilities. And then, you need not just one place, but another, because there was lack of leadership. Because previous Kalu Rinpoche passed away, he appointed somebody, but they didn't respect him because mm-hmm. of they do the comparison,
yeah.
and also as an excuse. And then, by the time I come, it's like, you know, they had this free lifestyle for 15 years. And when I came, it's a little bit like, oh yeah, we didn't know you are the boss. You know, it was like that kind of a reality. And then you had to, you know, take one step at a time. But it was very challenging because you cannot speak out to the public. You cannot find a quick solution.
Mm.
And it's not really... it's not really spiritual practice either.
Yeah, sure.
You know,
management, organization, and stuff.
Yes, yeah. yes. Which we don't get any training for that.
Yeah.
You know, so that time I started drinking and all the wild things. You know, but then I stopped after that, and then that's that. Mm. You know, so then I tell people not to do that also, because when people see themselves as, I'm a Vajrayana practitioner, yeah, and so on and so forth, and they use it as excuse. Oh yeah, I can drink alcohol, I can do whatever I want.
Yeah.
But that's another thing. You know, you can do whatever you want. If you can sleep and live in the cemetery your whole life, you can do whatever you want.
Yeah.
If you have that lifestyle, you know?
Yeah.
But if you cannot handle that lifestyle, but yet you want to do everything and you want to misuse everything that is taught, that is simply wrong. Hmm. You know? So, yeah.
Yeah, I once heard from one of my teachers. He said something. He said, "Well, you're allowed to drink, but you're not allowed to get drunk.
Yeah.
You know, it's okay if you have one beer, but exactly, you're not allowed to sort of compromise your state of mind,
mm-hmm,
when you're, you know, just generally practitioner, as you just mentioned. If you don't live there on the cemetery, you're not the Mahasiddha yet. You know,
exactly. So, yeah. So there was a lot of misconception that some group of people. So I had to, start refreshing again and again, at least for 5 years, just for that,
mm-hmm,
and just for reestablishing for 5 years. Mm-hmm. For last 3 to 4 years, it started to be more relaxed because everything started to become more transparent in terms of management, in terms of the future direction. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, yeah.
Okay. So, before we sort of finish this up, I would like to ask you, so what Kalu Rinpoche, the man, what do you enjoy? I know you are very busy and you're doing, but how do you enjoy, for example, sometimes we see you, you know, drinking a coffee or something. What is the sort of a daily kind of things that you would do to enjoy?
To enjoy?
Yeah, to just, let's say.
I like to go to the forest.
Mm.
Where you can just be quiet. I mean, I used to do lots of cycling,
mm-hmm,
you know, but then that turned out to be quite expensive for maintenance, yeah, for the wheels, for the chain, to clean.
The correct bike and
yes,
the gears,
exactly,
and everything. Yeah.
Yeah, that turned out to be quite a headache for, you know. And then I thought, okay, maybe that is not really a good hobby. But then, you know, I start to, you know, appreciate more going to the forest, listening to some music.
What kind of music do you enjoy?
It's more like just without any lyrics, just the instrument.
Yeah.
You know, like an example, like the German musician, he's Hans Zimmer.
Oh yeah, sure.
Yeah. A little bit, you know, quite strange.
Yeah, but
quite powerful.
He's the master. Yeah.
So I like his type of music, but at the same time, sometimes I just like whatever that is trending.
Yeah.
You know, on the radio, whatever is people listening.
Yeah.
You know, but at the same time, I kind of give up on my hobbies.
Mm.
I just try to go to the forest whenever I can, you know, go for a walk, running, you know. Mm. That's pretty much it.
Mm.
You know, when you stop drinking alcohol, there's not so much left that you can really...
You said that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So... Your main Dharma activity right now is it's not in Germany,
mm-hmm,
yet you do live here,
mm-hmm,
for a good portion of your time,
yeah,
and I understand that it's also to, you know, maybe get a little bit away, maybe to relax. Do you have any are there any Dharma activities in Germany that you're thinking, or would you like to keep it more separated?
I'm thinking about, you know, making some kind of a group.
Mm-hmm.
Without you know, purchasing any place,
mm-hmm,
or renting any place, you know, more like just an open group and once in a while a gathering and making a meditation course and so on and so forth, because we already have enough Dharma centers and the monasteries to manage to function. So, and my own personal lifestyle is basically like, you know, I travel every few months, mm-hmm, but when I do travel, I travel for at least 1 month. Like an example, from East Coast to West Coast,
mm-hmm,
I travel, you know, for a different state within our own centers, and also a public event as well. But here in Germany, I'm thinking about making an informal meditation group,
mm-hmm,
you know, and without being too serious about, you know, building a temple and, mm-hmm, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So I'm definitely thinking, and we're already starting,
mm-hmm,
you know, some small steps.
Yeah. Right. So if the listeners would like to hear more or see more from you, how can they, what resources should they join the Facebook, or what would you recommend?
I don't spend too much on so many different platforms. So the only common platform I use is the Facebook live streaming, because it's easier for the people to join.
And it's great. You do it once a week, so it's really continuing.
Yes,
every Sunday. People can ask questions and.
Yes. Yeah, it's like, that's something we started like since a few months ago.
Yeah.
So it's good. It's comfortable.
Yeah. And as I said, just in the back of your mind, the podcasting, maybe some consideration.
I'll look into it. I'll try.
Great. Thank you very much for your time and for sharing so openly, and also I think there was also a lot of very practical advice. So thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
Thank you.
Wenn dich die Themen aus dem Podcast interessieren und du dich darüber austauschen möchtest, dann lade ich dich herzlich in unsere Facebook-Gruppe ein. Du findest sie unter Stell dir vor, du wachst auf oder unter dem Kürzel 4O plus X. Das ist viermal der Buchstabe O plus X. Stell dir vor, du wachst auf. So heißt auch mein Buch, was erhältlich ist als Hörbuch, als E-Book und als gebundenes Buch. Und wenn du mit mir persönlich Workshops machen möchtest oder an Online-Programmen zu Meditation und Coaching und live teilnehmen möchtest, dann findest du immer die neuesten Infos auf Instagram unter dem Namen Curse Zeit, auf Facebook unter Curse Official oder auf meiner Website www.curse.de. Wenn du eine Nachricht direkt an uns schreiben willst, dann kannst du das machen an coaching@curse.de. Dankeschön und bis zum nächsten Mal.